If you were looking carefully at the sign out front, you will see that's a change from what I wrote on the sign out front yesterday. Yesterday I put four keys to overcoming the world. And the more I studied this passage yesterday and last night and today, as thinking about it, clearly there's an emphasis here upon our help for one another. And we'll see that and we'll talk about that. So I had to work that into the title. Four keys for helping one another, helping each other to overcome the world. Let's read verses 7 through 11, and then we'll talk a little bit in general about the book of 1 Peter, and then we'll come back to the passage. But the end of all things is at hand. Be ye therefore of sound mind, and be sober unto prayer. Above all things, being fervent in your love among yourselves, for love covereth a multitude of sins. Using hospitality one to another without murmuring, according as each hath received a gift, ministering it among yourselves as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If any man speaketh, speaking as it were oracles of God. If any man ministereth, ministering as the strength which God supplieth, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, whose is the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen. One of the major themes of the book of 1 Peter is the theme of suffering. If we were to go back into chapter 1 for just a moment and notice at verse 6, there the apostle says, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, ye have been put to grief in manifold trials. He began the book talking about the great hope that we have, the hope of heaven that we have been begotten again unto a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and to an inheritance that is incorruptible and undefiled and fades not away, reserved in heaven for you, wherein, verse 6, we greatly rejoice. What a joy, what a rejoicing to know and to understand that we have a home prepared for us, a home reserved for us in heaven. And we can rejoice even though, he says, now for a little while ye have been put to grief in manifold trials. This is the first, but it's not the last time that Peter will refer to the suffering that we go through. Go to chapter 2, verses 19 through 21. There he is talking to servants. And he says unto servants, for this is acceptable if for conscience toward God a man endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when ye are buffeted for it, ye shall take it patiently? But if ye do well and suffer for it, ye shall take it patiently. This is acceptable to God. For herein were you called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. And so he calls upon servants, calls upon all of us to suffer, when necessary, to suffer for those things which are right, because Christ also suffered for you. Look at chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. And he says, and who is it that will harm you if you are zealous of that which is good? But even if ye should suffer for righteousness' sake, blessed are ye. And fear not their fear, neither be troubled, but sanctify in your hearts Christ as Lord, being ready always to give answer to every man that asketh you a reason for the hope that is in you, yet with meekness and fear. And so he says here, who is he that will harm you if you're zealous of that which is good? Can men harm us physically? Absolutely. But can men take away our hope? Can men truly harm us? Even if you suffer for righteousness, he says, blessed are you. Now go to chapter 4, verses 12 through 16. This statement, of course, here in verse 16 is the best known of any of these that we have quoted so far, that we have read so far. He says in verse 12 through 16, think it not strange concerning the fiery trials which shall come upon you to prove you as though a strange thing has happened unto you. But inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, there's the theme again. Inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, rejoice that at the revelation of his glory ye may rejoice with exceeding joy. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, because the Spirit of glory and the Spirit of God resteth upon you. Let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or an evildoer, or a meddler in other men's matters. But if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in his name. If any suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but glorify God in this name. And so the theme of suffering goes throughout the book of 1 Peter. As Christians undoubtedly were under a great deal of pressure and persecution and trials during this period, to the middle to the late part of the first century. And persecution could come in many forms, of course. Persecution might come in a very strong physical way, with beatings or with imprisonments or even death. We know what Paul went through as we see his travels, as we have seen his travels, as Brother Brent has talked about in the book of Acts. But from other studies, we know that Paul suffered greatly, being beaten on a number of occasions and shipwrecked and in prison and one time stoned and left for dead. And so there could be physical persecution, and there was physical persecution. But there could also be other kinds of persecution, and he mentions that in the first four verses. Now look at the first few verses of chapter 4, in the verses just immediately before our text for this evening. He says, "For as much as Christ suffered in the flesh, arm ye yourselves with the same mind." There's our theme of suffering again. "Just as Christ suffered in the flesh, arm ye yourselves with the same mind. For that he that hath suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that ye no longer should live the rest of your life in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. For the time past may suffice to have wrought the desire of the Gentiles, and to have walked in lasciviousness, lust, wine bibbings, revelings, carousings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you." Your old friends are going to think you strange. Peter is talking to probably a mixed audience. We don't know for sure. There probably were some Jews among them. Those who had been Jews before had been converted to the gospel. But undoubtedly, a large number of them were Gentiles. And when he says that when you've armed yourself with the flesh, you are to cease from sin. When you put on Christ, you are to cease from sin. Verse 2, "And you should no longer live the rest of your life in the lusts of men, but to the will of God. For the time past may suffice to have wrought the desires of the Gentiles." He says, you lived there long enough. You lived that life long enough. It's time to stop. It's time to stop. You put that away. Continue to put it away. Don't let it come back to you. And so he talks about how that they had lived in lasciviousness and in lusts and wine bibbings and revelry and abominable idolatries. And he says, your old friends are going to think it's strange that you're not living like you used to live. Well, let them think that. They think you're crazy, let them think you're crazy. They think you've gone off your rocker, let them think you've gone off your rocker. That's all right. Don't live anymore that way. And so he goes on, of course, as he gets to the end of the chapter, "If any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed." Whatever the suffering may be, whether it be physical persecutions or beating or even death, or if it's just the fact that your friends think you're strange, that's okay too. "If any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but glorify God in this behalf." Well, let's go to the verses now that we read at the very beginning. So there's the theme. There's the theme, kind of framing this what it's all about in these chapters. But at the end of all things, he says here in these verses four things. And the reason I changed it to helping one another is, notice in these verses three different references to our one another relationship. And so he says in verse 8, "Above all things, be fervent in your love among yourselves." In your love among yourselves. Then in verse 9, "Using hospitality to one another." And then in verse 10, according as each hath received a gift, ministering it among yourselves as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. And so I think Peter is in this chapter, in these verses, giving us some keys to helping one another. We're to help one another. So we want to talk about that. As we live in this world, as we face these persecutions, as we face trials, we need one another. Now, before we get into the four things in particular, let's talk just for a moment about the beginning there in verse 7, where he says in verse 7, the end of all things is at hand. We're not going to talk about this in detail. There's a great deal of disagreement exactly what Peter is talking about here. Paul makes some statements in his epistles that are similar to this, but he says here that the end of all things is at hand. And there's been a lot of different opinions about exactly what Peter means here. I think it comes down to two possibilities, at least in my mind, as to what his reference is here. Brother Clinton Hamilton, in his commentary, a man that I admire and appreciate a lot, he has gone on to his reward, but was an excellent student, an excellent scholar. And Brother Hamilton has 12 pages just on this verse. He goes into the Greek in great detail and outlining different positions that have been taken. And so if you would like, I will just loan you that book and you can read through the 12 pages. It boils down to two positions. The end of all things that at hand. There are some who believe that Peter is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Some believe, and let me just mention this before I go to the two real possibilities. Some denominational or skeptical scholars have said, well, Peter just misunderstood. Peter thought that the end of the world was coming very quickly, and Peter was just mistaken about that. Well, as a human being, Peter could have been mistaken about some things, and we know he probably was. But Peter here was not writing as a human individual. He was writing as one who had the Spirit of God. And the Spirit of God doesn't make that mistake. And so he is not talking about the fact that Peter thought that the end of the world, the second coming of the Lord, was going to be just in a short period of time, and Peter just got it wrong. Peter didn't get things wrong when he was under the inspiration of the Spirit. So that's not the answer. The other two possible answers. One is the position that he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Most likely, history tells us that Peter died in the 60s, as the Apostle Paul probably also died in the 60s during the time of Nero. And if he did, then this writing was written before the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And undoubtedly, the destruction of Jerusalem was an important event. It was an important event in many ways. It was the end of the Jewish age. It was the end of the Jewish economy. Things changed for the Jews drastically after that. Their temple was destroyed. They did not have a place to go and worship as far as offering animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifice ceased at that time. They were scattered. They were already scattered, but they were scattered even more. They ceased being a nation. It was a red letter event in the history of Judaism. And it also affected Christians. There's no doubt it would have affected Christians because many in the Gentile world did not distinguish between Christians and Jews. They just saw them as one group together. They knew Jesus was a Jew, and so these Jews and Jews, they must all be the same, not understanding what had happened and not understanding the details. So sometimes Christians were persecuted because the Romans thought that they were Jews, and vice in those kind of situations. And so it was a big deal. And there are a number of very good scholars, very good students. Brother Robert Harkrider, we have used in several of his booklets and things that we have studied here in our congregation. Brother Harkrider believes it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and some other good students believe it as well. But Brother Hamilton takes the position. I tend to take this position. Not a big deal one way or the other. But it is my understanding, my belief, that when he talks about the end of all things is at hand, he's talking about the end of the world. He's talking about the second coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, the end of the messianic rule, the end of the kingdom, the end of time, the second coming. And someone says, well, how could that be? It says the end of all things is at hand. And I believe the interpretation of that would be is that at hand does not necessarily mean right away. It just means it can happen any time. It can happen any time. It's at hand. The near. Other places talk about the Lord is near. Is the Lord near right now? Yes. Is he going to walk through the door tonight and end all things? We don't know. But is he near? He is near. He is near. I've used the illustration before. I like it. I don't know if you like it or not. But it's kind of like when you're at the doctor. Ever been at the doctor? I'm at the chiropractor. And I'm sitting in the room. They put me in the room. I may wait there 5 minutes. I may wait there an hour. I just never know. And I hear him out there. I hear him talking to his nurses or his helpers. And he's walking up and down the hall. He has a very distinctive voice, my chiropractor does. And I can hear him out there. I can hear him, Dr. Monday, walking up and down the hall. Is he going to come into my room next or go to another room next? I just don't know. I could be there 5 minutes or I could be there an hour. I don't know. Somebody can answer that if they want to. Is that mine? It'll stop in a minute. It's recording and reading at the same time. Don't my friends know I'm preaching on Sunday between 5 and 6 o'clock in the evening? How dare they? How rude of them. So the doctor's out there and he may walk in any moment. He is at hand. And the Lord is at hand. The Lord is at hand. And he is as near to walking through at any moment in time and in history. We just don't know when. And so you can study those two and think about those two. But he says there in verse 7, the end of all things is near. We need to live life. As he goes on and gives these encouragements, we need to live our lives understanding that the Lord is at hand. Every day when we wake up, know the Lord is at hand. Every night when we pillow our heads, the Lord is at hand. Every day as we go about our business, and every day as we communicate with people, and every day as we talk to our wives and husbands, and I get a little ticked and want to say something I shouldn't, I need to remember the Lord is at hand. He could walk in at any moment. Do I want him to catch me being short with my wife as he walks in? And so I need to live my life every minute, every second, every day, understanding this could be the last. The Lord is at hand. And because the Lord is at hand, then four things. Number one, be of sound mind and be sober unto prayer. Be of sound mind, the American Standard. This is the American Standard. The new King James says, be serious and watchful in your prayers. The New American Standard says, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer. The ESV says, therefore, be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. NIV says, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. So as I think about all those different words, and they have a little bit different flavor, I just kind of combine some of them together. Let's think about some of those terms just for a moment. One of the terms that is used is watchful. We should be watchful, shouldn't we? The fact that the Lord is at hand, the fact that the Lord could walk through that door at any moment, I need to be watchful. I need to be watchful for you. I need to be watchful for me. I need to be watchful for others. I need to be watchful, as we talked about in Bible class this morning, for Satan and his devices and how he's seeking to lead me and others astray. Another word that was used here by the translators is serious. The word serious means earnest or sincere or thoughtful. We talk about a serious student. That word was not used of me when I was in college. But some are serious students. And we say, that person's a serious student. What does that mean? That means they study. They're very interested in their studies. They want to do well. They want to make a high mark. They want to make a high grade. I went with a fellow. He was a serious student. Why? He was trying to get into dental school. And he knew that his grades would be looked at by the dental school, even his freshman grades and sophomore grades. And so he wanted to do well. He was serious about his study. He was earnest. He was sincere. And that should describe us as we live our lives. We're to be sober or sober-minded. We understand what sober means. Physically sober means free of intoxicants, not drunk. I don't think Peter's talking about physical intoxication, although that would be included. Certainly, Christians should not be drunk on intoxication. But he's talking about that we should be, as one writer says, free of all mental and spiritual intoxicants. We should be free of anything that would pollute our minds. We should be free of anything that would keep us from thinking clearly. We should be free of anything that would keep us from being focused as a sober person is focused on what's before them, whether they're driving or whatever they're doing. They are sober. They are alert. We need to, as Christians, be sober and be alert and watchful. And fourthly of all, we need to be self-controlled. Another word that was used in one of those versions is self-control. And so we're self-controlled. Self-control means restraint. Self-disciplined. There are some people that are self-disciplined, very self-disciplined. Becky's father was a very self-disciplined individual. If he decided he was going to do something, he did it, and he never broke the rule. When his doctor told him to cut down on salt, he cut down on salt. He would go back to the doctor, and his blood pressure would be much lower, and the doctor would be amazed. But he did what the doctor said. He was told by the doctor one time that he had a problem with his lower back. He said, you're probably going to need surgery in a few years, but if you do these exercises religiously, they might help put off the surgery. He did the exercises every day. Every day. He never had the surgery. He wore a brace when he played golf. He never had the surgery. He was as disciplined a person that I've ever known. Well, that's what the Lord wants from us. He wants us to be disciplined. And self-control. Know what God's word is and do it. Listen to God's word and apply it. We know what self-control is when we're on a diet. We don't eat certain things. We know what self-control is when it comes to our tongue. We need to learn to be self-controlled in our spiritual lives. Doing and practicing those things. Be sound, of sound mind, and sober, and watchful, and serious, and self-controlled. Unto prayer. Number two, we are to be fervent in our love among ourselves. Verse 8. Fervent in our love among ourselves. Brethren, we need one another. We need one another. When we talk about the love that we have, we're not talking about an emotional love. There's an emotional part of even agape love. But that's not primarily the object or the idea. We are fervent in our love. We're fervent in our care, our interest, our help of one another. Love is the old word in the King James Version. The 1611 was the word charity. And I like that word because when we think of charity, what do we think of doing? Charity is something we give to someone. We give a charitable contribution. Charity is giving. And that's what love is. Love is charity. It's not necessarily the giving of money, but it's the giving of something. It's the bestowing of something on someone. And so love is doing. Love is an action word. Love among yourselves. Be fervent. We've been talking about zeal. And so a fervency, a burning. Be fervent as they were going through different things, as they were suffering and under the threat of the suffering of persecution and trials among them, they needed each other. We need each other. Maybe that's one thing we need to work on. I don't mean we, this congregation. I'm just talking generally. I think you do very well in your love for one another, your concern you're showing for one another. But that's important. That's critical. We need to be concerned about one another. We need to be showing that love to one another. Why? Because we have challenges. We have challenges. It became evident this morning when our brother Philip wrote that statement that he wanted our prayers. I don't know what it is that in particular is challenging him right now. I haven't talked to him. I'm sure if I asked him, he would tell me. He's always been very open with me and close. But my point is, I don't know. But something is challenging him right now, and we need to be there for him. We need to be encouraging him. We need to be writing him notes. We need to be helping him. We need to be thinking about him. We need to be taking him to lunch somewhere. We need to be drawing closer to him. Be fervent in your love for one another. Why? Because we need each other. We need each other. Satan's out there. He's a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. We need to be fervent in our love for one another. Ben Franklin once said, at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Ben Franklin said, "We must hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately." Those who signed the Declaration understood what they were signing. If they lost that war, they were signing their death notice. The king didn't put up with rebels. Rebels were hung. And Franklin was literally telling the truth when we said, "We'll either hang together or we'll hang separately." They were facing a challenge. They were facing, amazingly, the most powerful army in the world at that time, the British Army. And how we beat them to this day, historians don't know. I mean, they can talk about it and talk about this happened. But it's still an amazing victory that we won our freedom. And so he understood that principle. We need to understand that principle. We're going to hang together or we're going to hang separately. We are in a battle. We are in a fight as we were against the British. And we talked about this morning the passage from Ephesians chapter 6. Put on the whole armor of God. We're not going to reread it this evening. But put on the whole armor of God. Put it on individually. Work together. Love one another. Show that passion and that care for one another. We need each other. Number three, he says, and this is another offshoot of love, is the hospitality one to another without murmuring. And so he says in this verse, in verse 9, use hospitality one to another without murmuring. When he says hospitality here, he's not necessarily talking about having one and over for dinner, although that's wonderful to have that kind of association together as we enjoy one another's company. Literally, the word means love of strangers. You can think about the passage in Genesis chapter 18. Think about Genesis chapter 18. Where Abraham and Sarah were visited by three men. At the beginning of that exchange, of course, they had no idea who they were. And so when these three strangers come, they showed hospitality to them. And Abraham had quickly ran off and prepared an animal and the making of bread and the cooking of things for these men. It must have taken some time. You got to go kill the animal. You've got to skin the animal. You've got to take the meat and cook it. It took a little while, but they showed hospitality, and they showed great hospitality to these three. They didn't realize that they were angels. Look over at Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2 says, "Forget not to show love unto strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." Doesn't mention Abraham, does it? Is there any doubt who he's talking about? Any doubt who he's talking about? Forget not to show love to strangers. And so the word hospitality, literally the showing love unto strangers. And so God's people were to show hospitality, not just to one another in the body of Christ, but even unto strangers. Now, there may have been a couple of different reasons why this in particular was emphasized. One, we are told, they didn't have Holiday Inns and places like that, Ramada Inns, and the dozens and dozens of hotel choices that we have. We know from the story of the Good Samaritan that there was something akin to an inn and places where people could stay. But generally, they were not available or used like they are today. And as people would travel and they would need to stay, others, it was a tradition among the Jewish people to take in strangers and give them a place to stay as they were traveling. And this was, of course, also became true of Christians, as Christians would travel. And so they would take people in, and they would especially feel comfortable with other Christians and not with others. And so here the apostle says to show hospitality to one another without murmuring. The other possibility is, we see in the book of Hebrews chapter 10, it talks about some whose possessions had been spoiled. Look back for a moment to Hebrews chapter 10. Look at 32 to 34. It says, "But call to remembrance the former days, in which after ye were enlightened, ye endured a great conflict of suffering." Once again, notice the theme of suffering. "Partly being made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them that were so used. For ye both had compassion on them that were in bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions, knowing that you have yourself a better possession, an abiding one." What's he saying? There were some of them that were under persecution. There were some of them that were under trials. Some of them had lost possessions. Some of them had the spoiling of their possessions. That has happened in other countries. That has happened in the past in China. People who were Christians, their apartments were taken away. Their jobs were taken away. They came into need. Someone needed to take care of them. If someone took away your possessions, someone took away your home, someone took away your job, what would you do? We don't have to face that in this country, but in some countries they've had to face it, and some of these early Christians were facing that, the spoiling of their possessions. What would happen? Well, my guess is other Christians would take them in. Show love to one another and take them in. What does that mean? Well, that means me and my wife and my three or four children in a house that's already not big enough for the six of us, taking another family with three or four children, and we're sleeping practically on top of each other. And we're trying to figure out a way how we're going to feed everybody. And it would be easy for us in that situation to do a little murmuring. Why do I have to do this? Lord, why have you put this upon me and upon us? We hardly have enough to feed our own kids. It would be easy to not have a good attitude about it, wouldn't it? And Peter says, show hospitality to one another without murmuring. You are facing some situations that may be difficult. There's persecution that's going on among you. You need to be fervent in your love and even show hospitality to one another without murmuring. And number four, as each has received a gift, ministering it among yourselves as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. And so he says, as each has received a gift. We all have gifts. Different ones have gifts. We could go to a number of passages. I had some. For sake of time, I'm not going to turn and read them. You know the passages. You know passages like Romans chapter 12, where it talks about the different gifts that we have, the different abilities that we have. You know the passage in Matthew chapter 25 and the parable of the talents. And the principle there that he gave to one 5, to one 2, and to one talent according to their abilities. We have different abilities. We're differing according to abilities. And the scriptures talk about that over and over again. And so he is saying in this passage, there's going to be different ones that have different abilities. Different ones have different, therefore, responsibilities. And he says, according as each hath received a gift. Was he talking about miraculous spiritual gifts or just gifts of talents like teaching and ministering and serving? It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter either way you take it. If each and anyone who has received a gift, ministering it, sharing it among yourselves as good stewards, we are stewards of the manifold grace of God. We are stewards and not owners. We are servants. We are God's people serving together, trying to help each one get to heaven, encouraging, holding up each other's hands. And so each has received a gift, minister it among yourselves. Use it among yourselves as the manifold grace, as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If any man speaketh, speaking as it were the oracles of God. Do you have the ability to speak? Then speak as the very words of God. If any man ministered, can you serve in some other way than a ministering it among yourselves as the strength which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified? Whatever we do, we get too self-centered oftentimes. Thinking about me and my time and my family. But I need to be thinking about others. Whatever gifts we have, ministering it among yourselves as stewards. I'm a steward of Jesus Christ. I'm a slave of Jesus Christ. I am living for Him and I'm serving for Him. And anyone who speaks, speak as the oracles of God, not your own opinions or anything else. We often use this passage on the subject of authority. Speak the oracles of God, but speak God's message. And if you're going to minister, if you're going to serve, serve as the strength which God supplies. You serve fully. You do everything you can, and you use your service. That people will pat you on the back. No, that's not why you're doing it. So that the preacher will put your name in the bulletin for trimming the hedges. No, that's not why you're doing it. I may do that and say thank you, but that's not your motivation. That God may be glorified. That God may be glorified. And He's glorified when we work and we do His work together. And through all the ups and downs and through all the challenges, we continue to serve Him and live for Him. Encouraging one another, worshiping with one another, helping one another for the goal of getting to heaven. The end of all things is near. The end of all things is near. Each and every day we live with that understanding. The end of all things is near. And tomorrow it'll be near. It may not happen for 1,000 years, but each and every day as we live, it's near. It could happen at any time. And God is watching. Well, the lesson is yours. If we can encourage you tonight in any way, if we can help you in any way, if we can assist you in any way by helping you to obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, or if you have something in your life that you want to share with us that we might assist you and help you and encourage you tonight, you can let that be known while together we stand and while we sing.